From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley at South Carolina Public Radio in Columbia, South Carolina. It's Here Now. Financial markets are closing out of a terrible week of the biggest losses since 2008 as investors react to fears the coronavirus could become a global pandemic. If it does, some analysts are warning that it could tip the world's economy into a global recession. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, we still don't know if the coronavirus will put a halt to the market's 10 years of historic growth. But what are you hearing from experts?
I think, as you put it, the jury is still out is probably the best way to describe it. I mean, the main problem here is that investors rely a lot on companies themselves and their own forecasts for sales and profits in order to make their own buy and sell decisions. So the problem here is the virus has caused a lot of companies, from Apple to many smaller companies, to basically withdraw those forecasts. And understandably, they're saying, look, we just don't know how bad of a hit this is going to be to our business. So, you know, that really starves investors of the vital information they want to make decisions, not only in the stock market, but in the corporate bond market, which is super important to sort of the health of financial markets. So, you know, this could end up being a major overreaction, but we just don't know yet due to this virus being so unpredictable.
Yeah. You know, we say this often, but it's worth saying again that the stock market is not the same thing as the economy. But makes sense for us how this coronavirus could actually hurt the broader economy.
If you look at China, for example, I mean, they took major steps to try to reduce the human toll of this virus. But in doing so, they basically had to shut down the vast majority of their economy, closing factories, closing movie theaters. They closed Shanghai Disneyland. Yeah. And it's often being described as both a supply shock and a demand shock. In other words, you close a factory. Imagine making a product with 100 parts in it. If you're missing just one of those, then obviously you can't finish that product and sell it. So that's the supply shock. On the demand side, it's just consumers either being quarantined involuntarily, or their restaurants and malls being closed, that sort of thing, or even voluntarily just being afraid to travel, afraid to go out to the concert venue, to the movie theater, that sort of thing. So it's both a supply and demand shock, which is a very, very dangerous thing for the economy.
Sure. I'm wondering how the Fed is weighing in on all of this. Could we actually see another interest rate cut in March?
Well, so if you look at – you can look at the futures market on Wall Street and sort of suss out what investors expect and are betting on. And they're basically pricing in not only a cut at the March meeting, but maybe 3 or 4 quarter percentage point cuts by the end of the year. There is a lot of speculation that the Fed may even have to act before their March meeting. And there's a lot of speculation that they could possibly do something in coordination with other global central banks. I mean, I will say that is just pure trader and investor speculation. At the moment, the Fed hasn't really indicated yet that they're ready to do anything. The assumption is they will. The big question is, though, will it matter?
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit more about how this could all play into the disruption of the global supply chain? You kind of talked a little bit about what's happening in China, and others have pointed out that while an interest rate cut could potentially spur people to spend more, that doesn't do anything to help the fact that on the supply side, as you mentioned, many factories are still closed. We even know about the port of Los Angeles, the Western Hemisphere's biggest port, is already expecting its biggest decline in volume since the financial crisis. How significant? Can you go a little bit deeper in that into the supply chain?
Yeah, it's a major, major deal, at least in the short term, that you could measure in, say, months or maybe a quarter or two. China is trying to get their production back online. But obviously, by doing that, they also risk the threat of causing the virus to sort of reemerge and start spreading faster again. But when you think about supply chains, I'll give you one example. There's a home builder that reported its latest financial results this week. And you think, well, a U.S. home builder, they're pretty isolated from all these sort of supply chain problems. But they talked about, well, what if they can't get their hands on the lighting fixtures they need, or say the appliances? You know, you could finish a home but not be able to put in that washer and dryer or the light over the kitchen table. And, you know, maybe you won't be able to close on that home sale because of those last few things that you don't have. So The problem with the supply chain is that it can – this disruption can show up in any number of places and really disrupt business in ways that people are going to be surprised with, I think, if it continues.
Yeah. With the 30 seconds I have with you, I think a lot of people are wondering, what should you do if you have a personal stake in the markets? Should you ride this out or really sell before it gets worse?
Right. You know, I think that answer depends on the individual. I think pretty much every financial advisor will tell you, if you're a long-term investment, if you're saving for retirement, that's many years down the road, it's never really a good idea to sell when the market's weak, because you're basically guaranteeing locking in those losses. You know, the old adage is to sort of ride it out, to just not even look at your 401k.
Yeah. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, NATO is calling on Russia and Syria to de-escalate tensions in Syria's Idlib province after an airstrike on rebel forces there killed 33 Turkish troops last night. Turkey, which backs the opposition to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, said it killed dozens of Syrian soldiers today in retaliation. For more, we're joined now by the BBC's Lena Sinjab. She's in Beirut. And Lena, Idlib is the last stronghold for the opposition in this long Syrian civil war. What happened there last night?
Well, last night it was the peak of escalation in the area, where the Syrian government and the army pushing further and provoking Turkey by attacking a Turkish military position, killing at least 33 Turkish soldiers. Turkey has been a warning for long now, for several weeks after the assault on Idlib, started by the Syrian regime, backed by Russia, actually, and Russian warplanes were involved in the assault on Syrian opposition and civilians. But what happened last night is just like adding to the tension and provoked retaliation from Turkey, which may leave the situation in a bigger escalation to come soon.
And the context is that Turkey stepped up its involvement last year in Syria when it decided to send troops into Syria to push back the Kurdish militias from the border. The Turks see Kurdish fighters as terrorists, and that happened after the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But what more do we know today about Turkey's retaliation against the Syrian government for what happened last night?
Well, you know, the Syria conflict is not a very simple conflict. It's very complex, and it's almost like a proxy war taking place on a Syrian land. So although Turkey has been, since 2018 at least, in coordination with Russia, who backs the Syrian regime, the government has provoked Turkey, who has soldiers on the ground, as you rightly said. But these recent escalation, the government pushing back and pushing all the rebels out, pushing at least 1 million refugees since December, attacking schools, attacking hospitals, attacking markets. So Turkey felt under a lot of threat. We have to remember that Turkey is also hosting 3.5 million Syrian refugees. And now this attack on their soldiers is like threatening them or trying to invite them into further escalation.
Russia says it was not involved in this attack. But of course, Russia, as you've mentioned, has been involved in carrying out the Syrian airstrikes in this area. So what are we to believe about how culpable Russia is?
So it's hard to believe that Russia may have carried out attacks directly against Turkey. You know, we have to remember that Turkey also is a NATO member. We already heard that, the talks between Russia and Turkey is resuming this afternoon. There will be a meeting for NATO members to discuss the situation. And they want to find a diplomatic way to reduce this tension. Certainly, countries of NATO, they don't want to be involved in a war inside Syria, where Russia and its military and its warplanes are based and stationed.
Well, how delicate is this diplomacy for NATO, who, as you say, is trying to negotiate here between the parties, but also must feel pressure to come to the defense of one of its members?
It's a very delicate situation indeed, but also there is a point, because Turkey came under attack not inside Turkish land. They came under attack inside Syria, so on a different soil. That could be a way for NATO to say, we're not going to get involved in a war in another country, not on your own land or own territory. But of course, you know, there is also another flag that Turkey is raising, which is the refugee flag. We've heard the Turkish authorities saying today that they're going to open the border again towards Europe. We already hear reports or unconfirmed reports of hundreds of Syrian refugees heading towards the border with Greece. So there are so many concerns and many players who are worried about further escalation for that. Of course, Turkey wants the attention of NATO and the support of NATO, but they also want the attention and support of Europe, you know, because they feel that they're left alone to face both Syrian forces and Russian forces inside Idlib. So they need to find a different solution and grab the attention of the world again to the Syria case.
That's the BBC's Lena Sinjab reporting from Beirut. Lena, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Each of us is the star in the movie of our life. But how much of a role do we play in other people's movies?
It was a really sort of palpable fear that they were going to reject me or worse.
The unseen pressures we place on other people, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
We're here in South Carolina ahead of tomorrow's primary election. And from the moment our feet hit the ground in Charleston, it was clear why tourism is the number one industry in the state. There's tons to experience. The food, the shopping, the coast, the pampering. People who come here to see it all are a big part of what's fueling this state's economy. Over the next few minutes, we're going to take you on a road trip from Charleston to Columbia to hear from some of the hardworking people of South Carolina about what they want in a presidential candidate and how this time around, picking the perfect one isn't as clear-cut as in years past. We start in Charleston.
My name is Alfonso Brown, and I'm the owner-operator of Gullah Tours.
Okay, so you might be wondering, what exactly is Gullah? Well, it's this complex mix of African and American culture and a preservation of language from black slaves who were brought here hundreds of years ago. I asked Brown to teach me a little.
We want to unravel my mouth about.
Keep going.
We want to unravel my mouth about. We want me for unravel my mouth about. What do you want me to say about? You know, many of the rest of one of it. Yeah, that's the one of it. Yeah.
Brown, who is 74 years old, was raised about 12 miles outside of Charleston. And for about 30 years now, he's been one of the only tour guides giving visitors a view of his home state through the Gullah culture.
They're all doing a little black history, but not exclusively like I am doing. Matter of fact, I'm the only tour guide to go on the east side of town, up in the hood.
On this day, Brown had visitors from Pennsylvania, Michigan, and as far away as Denmark. They came to town this week for the Democratic debate. He stands in front of them on the tour bus, explaining a little about the origins of the Gullah language.
Gullah is Gullah. Gullah is a Creole-based language, like the French Creole, but with English as its main base. For an example, if you go to the restaurant and you ordered a poulet sandwich, what are you getting? Poulet, French for? Poulet.
Oh, poulet. That's chicken.
Chicken, yeah. But in Gullah, we don't call it poulet. We call it pullet, like they do in England. Pullet. My grandmama said to me sometime, boy, go on outside and check on them pullet.
Brown says several of the presidential candidates have taken this tour over the years. Just a few days ago, candidate Michael Bloomberg went for one. Brown loves all of this. And in thinking about his mother and father and their mothers and fathers who didn't have the right to vote, voting is what he gets the most excited about. The 2008 primary was easy. Barack Obama was a natural choice. In 2016, it was Hillary Clinton. But this time around, things feel a little more complicated.
I was a Biden fan. And then one day on TV, I wasn't looking at it, but I heard this person speaking on the TV, and he was speaking and campaigning and everything. And I said, is that Obama on the TV again? And I looked, and it was with a man named Buttigieg. I still pronounced his name wrong. And he just made me want to vote for him because it sounded like Obama. You know, these things happen. And but I don't know. I'm still undecided.
Brown is thinking about his three sons and his eight grandchildren. What do they need in a president? Who's going to be the Democratic candidate that thinks about their future and the future of the less fortunate?
What I want from a candidate is what they can do for those who's not privileged, who maybe less privileged. I got what I want now at my age. What else more can anybody give me or do for me? And so therefore my concern is for others who need what they have to offer. And so if I vote for a candidate, I'll vote for him for what that person can do for someone else, you know.
Brown represents one of the thousands fueling the engine of Charleston tourism. But about 2 hours north, in the capital of Columbia, we stopped by Tolliver's Main Event Barbershop, a place where ideas about life and politics are always the topics of the day. It's where I met Willie Evans, taking a break from cutting hair.
I'm cutting hair all my life. I love it. You know, I come every day. They pick on me about getting here so early, but I never come to work. I love doing what I do.
Evans talked about watching the debates, what he liked and what he didn't like. But when I asked him what candidate he trusted, he paused before answering.
Trust? Trust. It's hard to say trust. I put it to you like this, sir. I trust Biden the most. I put it that way. But I trust none of them, but I trust Biden the most. I don't know if that's a good answer.
Tom Steyer and Pete Buttigieg signs and billboards line the streets and corners here. And you can't turn on the TV without being inundated with political ads. There's even quite a few Tulsi Gabbard ads and people walking around the city with Elizabeth Warren buttons. But this is Biden country. There's no doubt about it. And the reasons why, at least here at this barbershop, have less to do with Vice President Biden's platform, although there is talk about some of the key issues here, and more to do with what Biden represents. It's like when your best friend or family member gives you advice on a decision to make. They trust former President Barack Obama here and Congressman Jim Clyburn, who yesterday endorsed Obama's VP, Joe Biden.
Come on, mama got a saying, you are part of who you associate with.
Christopher Tolliver Sr. runs this shop with his father, Herbert.
Barbershop has been here since January the 21st, 1976. This is our fourth location on the same side of town.
All of Tolliver's clients are like family. They either went to school together, church together, or live near each other. And without prompting, almost all of them talked about Biden. In a way, at least for Tolliver, he credits Biden with helping elect the first black president.
I can remember watching TV in here, and it was two endorsements that gave me the idea that Barack Obama would become president of the United States, and that would be Senator Ted Kennedy, who has departed from us, and Joe Biden, Senator Joe Biden.
And so for Tolliver, supporting Biden is almost like thanking him for standing behind Obama. But that's not all.
To me, we feel like he's fought the good fight. And we want to be there for him now as far as supporting him to become the president of the United States. We feel he's a good person.
When you say he's fought the good fight, what do you mean by that?
Him trying to eliminate private prisons, him trying to raise the minimum wage up to $15 an hour, and him having paid leave for families who become sick.
This framing is a nuanced one because it's a different narrative than the one we often hear. It signifies that at least here, a vote for Biden is sort of like a thank you for standing behind a black man for president.
We got to stick together. I'm going to say us are for the human race. I don't want to put a color on this thing. I'd rather say out of all the candidates, like I said, I trust none of them, but I trust Biden the most.
The fire we've been hearing about finding a candidate that can beat President Trump, isn't burning as hot here. Evans actually doesn't feel Trump is a bad president.
Me particularly, I don't dislike him or like him. I like the fact that there's a lot of more jobs on the street now. You know, you can go get more jobs now. But I also don't like him because of his views on women and his views on race, you know.
And not everyone who comes into this shop will be voting for Biden, even though the respect is here. Tolliver's wife is eyeing businessman Tom Steyer, and Tolliver says his younger clients have come in supporting other candidates.
Younger people, which they have a right to feel this way, to me don't know the history of what Joe Biden has meant to the African-American community as far as standing up for civil rights. So when they look at, let's say, a Bernie Sanders, they see a man that wants to give away, let's say, free education or wants to have free health care. I'm not against the free health care because I believe that is a right for all Americans. But I am against free education. The older generation, we're more conservative. So what we're asking for is just a fair shake. And we'll go out here and work to get what we need as far as in society. We don't want to have a handout.
This road trip is one that all of the Democratic presidential candidates are taking, crisscrossing South Carolina, vying for voters in a state that could propel their race to the nomination. And an update on Alfonso Brown, the co-owner of Gullah Tours we met earlier. He called me late last night to tell me he's made a decision on a candidate. After hearing Congressman Jim Clyburn endorse Joe Biden, he's decided he'll back Biden too. On our road trip, we also heard from other voters about their concerns.
My name is Alexis Klein. I would describe myself as a small business owner, non-traditional student, and a Charleston, South Carolina resident. What I want most in a president is a president that thinks about everybody outside of himself. While we do need to focus on infrastructure in our country, we also need to be a little bit more mindful about our relationships outside of the country. There's a lot of people in the world and a lot of good that we can do, but it seems that there's also a lot of damage we can do. So we just need to be a little more conscious of that.
My name is Jeff Parrish. I'm retired, but I'm driving part-time as a rideshare driver, trying to put a roof on my house without going into debt to get it. I live in Walterboro, South Carolina. I voted for Donald Trump in 2016. I'm being very open-minded. I'm willing to listen to new and fresh ideas. And Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg are the ones that I'm most interested in. They are absolutely different from the typical politician. But right now, there's no one that I would choose over Donald Trump.
As Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders surges in primaries, he has the backing of one small but passionate group, Muslims in America. From member station WAMU, Daniela Cheslow reports.
About 200 people kneel in socks on the carpet of a hotel ballroom in Gainesville. The Muslim population of Northern Virginia is growing fast, and this community is still building a mosque. 20-year-old Mukhaira Khan wears Bernie Sanders pins on her pink headscarf. She holds a stack of Muslims for Bernie flyers.
We face a lot of Islamophobia, and Bernie Sanders is a candidate that has spoken up for us, and it's important to talk to our community and also garner our community's support.
There are no primary polls of Muslim Americans, but two national groups, Engage PAC and the Muslim Caucus of America, recently endorsed Sanders. The caucus chairwoman told me she listened to Sanders' message early because his national campaign manager is Faz Shakir, a Muslim Pakistani-American. Ilhan Omar, one of the first Muslim women in Congress, is a frequent surrogate. The 78-year-old Jewish senator with a Brooklyn accent has become an unlikely star for Leila al-Nozeli. She's 20 and came to a party for Sanders volunteers in Alexandria, Virginia.
He speaks for the working man. He speaks for the Muslim woman. He speaks for everyone in America. I love him. I love him so much.
Political scientist Mark Rozelle at George Mason University says Sanders' longstanding support for a group that feels victimized sends a message that resonates beyond the 3.5 million Muslims in the U.S.
Many minority Americans who have had to go through the struggle of achieving acceptance by mainstream society would understand those groups today who are going through similar type struggles that maybe their parents or grandparents had to suffer through.
The issues Sanders advocates can divide Democrats. He has long skipped the conferences of the pro-Israel group AIPAC. This year, he added that AIPAC gives a platform for leaders who express bigotry. Other Democrats condemned his stance, but Sanders doubled down in the most recent debate.
In Israel, through Bibi Netanyahu, you have a reactionary racist who is now running that country. And I happen to believe that what our foreign policy in the Mideast should be about is absolutely protecting the independence and security of Israel. But you cannot ignore the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Other candidates, including Elizabeth Warren, have reached out to Muslims. Sanders alone has inspired an affection close to family. Hamza Raza, a divinity student at Harvard University, says when Sanders had a heart attack in October, he wrote on Instagram suggesting maybe it would help if a group read through all 600 pages of the Quran, the Muslim holy book. Raza says he quickly ran out of pages to assign. He says the term ammo, Arabic for uncle, has taken off.
So when people call him Ammo Bernie, it's sort of a sign of respect, a sign of endearment, and a sign of holding him in high regard. I also saw these people on Twitter. They jokingly call him Bernie Muhammad Sanders.
Raza says helping the weak, the Sanders creed, is what the Prophet Muhammad preached. For NPR News, I'm Daniela Cheslow in Gainesville.
The CDC warned American schools and businesses this week to prepare for a potential outbreak of COVID-19. And today, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney went a little further.
Are you going to see some schools shut down? Probably. May you see impacts on public transportation? Sure, but we do this. We know how to handle this.
Well, let's see how schools are handling this. Melinda Landau is manager of health and family support programs at San Jose Unified School District in California. Melinda, welcome.
Thank you.
And we just heard Mick Mulvaney say that we know how to handle this. Do you agree? Are schools ready? Do they know how to handle this?
I do agree. We know how to handle this. We've been through several health emergencies in the past. We survived the H1N1. In fact, we thrived during the H1N1 crisis. We developed systems in place back in 2009 that we've spent the last 10 years refining, and I'm confident that we're in a position that we can monitor and help mitigate the situation.
Okay, and I'm going to ask you about some of the techniques that you're using. But first, I just want to also ask, you know, you are very close, just a couple hours south of the county in California where CDC officials believe they found the very first person who contracted the virus from inside the community. When you hear that news, does it kind of raise the stakes inside your school district?
Well, it certainly raises awareness. It raises awareness with our parents, our staff. We are carefully monitoring the situation. I think it's important for us to do that. We have done extra training with our staff on making sure that everybody is monitoring for symptoms. We are looking for any spike in symptoms. We are sending cleaning crews out to disinfect classrooms and offices where students who have had symptoms are. We've had a lot of practice at this, and we are ready for it.
And what does that mean, sending crews out to clean classrooms? Is that different than something you would normally do?
You know, normally our classrooms get cleaned every day. That's standard. When we have an outbreak or a spike in symptoms in a classroom, we may send out a crew who does disinfecting rather than just cleaning. So they come with the appropriate cleaner. They let it sit. They wipe it down. So the classroom is disinfected.
What about the fact that, you know, schools are kind of notorious for being germ factories, for lack of a better word? lots of kids, lots of teachers in close contact with each other. What are you doing to make sure that everyone who's in the school is staying as hygienic as possible?
We're pushing hand washing. A lot of our nurses are going around and doing hand washing trainings, especially in the lower grades. We have special glow germs where they can see the germs and see the transmission of germs. We're encouraging our families to help us with hand washing at home, ensuring that their kids are washing their hands before they eat, after they use the restroom, making sure that they cover their coughs. Making sure that if you use a tissue, and this goes for adults too, you use a tissue, don't put it on the counter. Once you put it on the counter, now the counter is infected. Throw it away.
And what's this you said about glow germs? What's that?
Glow germs, you put it on the hand, and then you put a black light on it, and it will glow. We ask the children to wash their hands, and then we'll look again at their hand under the black light, and we can see the areas where they missed. That's to help teach them that they really do need to do the 20-second cleaning. They need to remember that they have a back of their hand as well. You often see children, and they'll rub their hands together, but they forget that the back of their hands can also have germs on them.
Okay, so it sounds like you're using this as a bit of a teachable moment, even having a little bit of fun doing it. But, I mean, look, this is serious. If we get to a point where health officials say it's time to close schools, and we've already seen this in places like Japan and South Korea and Italy. Do you think as a public health professional that that's an effective strategy?
You know, I leave that to our public health officials to decide. In H1N1, we did have a local school not in our district closed. It was closed for a couple of days, but they decided that that was not the most effective way to slow the spread of H1N1. We know that the spread of H1N1 was better mitigated by the efforts that we are doing right now. During H1N1, they were quickly developed a vaccination, and in our district, we did over 16,000 doses. We do have the nurses available to us, and should a vaccination become available, we will be working with our public health department to see if we can make that happen.
I'm sure parents are very concerned. I mean, more than just the idea of schools potentially shutting down, what are you going to do with your kids, what are you going to do about work, but just about the infection in general. What are you hearing from parents?
The parents are very concerned. We're getting messages. We're hearing that they're hearing stories that are maybe sensationalized. I would advise parents to look at the reliable sources of information. We want parents to know that we are on this. Our district has gone through a continuous improvement cycle on handling just these situations since H1N1. We know how to monitor. We know how to help stop the spread of viruses. And whatever happens, we are prepared to support them and their students.
Melinda Landau, Manager of Health and Family Support Programs at San Jose Unified School District in California, talking about how schools might respond to a COVID-19 outbreak here in the United States. Melinda, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
As we just heard from Melinda, and really as we've been hearing all week, this outbreak has disrupted life around the world, from those schools to the stock market to farmers markets. It includes the livelihoods of gooey duck clam fishermen in the Pacific Northwest. You can't forget about those guys. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Eric Stone reports.
It's a weird-looking animal, the gooey duck clam. It looks a little like a steamer.
But it's 2.5 to 3 pounds in weight, and then the neck on it is about – it can be up to 3 foot long neck. So you have this giant clam with a giant neck.
That's Phil Doherty. He's based in Ketchikan, Alaska, and helps lead an organization of fishermen who dive underwater and scour the seabed looking for the giant bivalves along the coast of the Pacific Northwest. Though gooey ducks are native to the Western Hemisphere, Doherty says most of the catch goes to China, where it's a delicacy. And their phallic shape has given gooey ducks a reputation as an aphrodisiac. But Doherty says that with the recent coronavirus outbreak, demand has plummeted.
All of the restaurants, or the vast, vast majority of restaurants, are closed. The vast majority of seafood markets are closed.
And there's another wrinkle.
It's all a live market, and that's where kind of the rub comes in. It's a live market.
So that means gooey ducks can't be frozen or canned and saved for later.
You're only looking at about a 4-day window between harvesting the gooey duck and wanting them sold.
That's dive fisherman Jeremy Layton. Breathing from an air supply aboard his boat, he looks for the telltale necks and uses something a little like a household pressure washer to dig gooey ducks out of the seafloor. He says he spends 2 days a week in the winter racing to fill up his boat with up to 1,000 pounds of gooey duck clams. He sells his catch to buyers on the docks here in Ketchikan. But lately...
Well, most of the divers are just kind of uncertain of what's going to happen. We're all sitting on the beach hoping to go to work.
Layton says he can usually sell his haul for $5 to $10 per pound, sometimes more. But with the Chinese market essentially shut down, they're going for about $1 a pound. So recently, divers held an emergency meeting of the Gooey Duck Committee. That's a group of 20 undersea fishermen to talk about what to do next. Layton chairs the committee, and he says it was a tough call.
I mean, some guys are broke now and they want to go to work.
But he says a majority of divers decided that with prices so low, it just didn't make sense. In Washington state, it's not just divers feeling the pinch. The state auctions off the right to dive on particular sections of the coast. The revenue is used to help restore salmon habitat. Joe Smiley with the Washington Department of Natural Resources says 35% tariffs that came about as part of the U.S.-China trade war had already cut auction revenue in half. And now the coronavirus outbreak has demand at a standstill. So he says...
Things are not looking good for salmon as a result of this as well.
Divers in British Columbia say they're facing hard times too. Most haven't fished in a month. Back in Ketchikan, diver Jeremy Layton says he's seen the gooey duck fishery shut down before, like during the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s. But he says the scale and open-endedness of the coronavirus outbreak have divers worried.
To all of a sudden just shut down, everybody's kind of in shock, you know, not expecting it. And they're just like, okay, now what do we do?
Layton says he's got enough savings to scrape by until next winter if he has to. He says some divers will likely take their boats south to dive for sea urchins. But for now, all Layton can do is sit on the beach and hope he can get back to work on the seafloor soon. For Here and Now, I'm Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Alaska.
After South Carolina's 54 delegates are tallied up this weekend, the spotlight shifts to Super Tuesday. In Texas, Senator Bernie Sanders holds a narrow lead over his opponents in the polls. A new Univision poll shows him with 26% support among registered Democrats, double what he was polling at last fall. Here he was last week at a rally in San Antonio.
We are bringing our people together. Black and white and Latino, Native American, Asian American.
The polls show Sanders has doubled his support among a critical Texas demographic, Latino voters. Nearly a third of Latino voters in the poll favored Sanders. Meanwhile, the poll shows former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg in second place in front of his former Vice President Joe Biden. Other recent polls have shown the opposite, Bloomberg trailing Biden. Okay. Let's go now to North Carolina, where 110 delegates are at stake. For Democrats, Charlotte, the state's largest city, is critical, especially getting votes in the city's black communities. Charlotte is also one of eight locations NPR is visiting and revisiting from now through November, asking where voters are. Steve Harrison from member station WFAE reports.
Last week, Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley came to Charlotte to rally more than 100 volunteers who canvassed for Elizabeth Warren on a Saturday morning.
I'm not here just to fight for Elizabeth Warren. I'm here to fight for Elizabeth Warren because she's here to fight for all of us.
Yes. As a thank you to her supporters, the Warren campaign had a couple boxes of donuts. But there's a more extravagant way to win voters' support. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg's campaign brought a Jamaican food truck to downtown Charlotte this week and gave out free dinner to anyone who would engage with the campaign by text.
Hey, can I have some chicken, please?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Do you have a text
message? I do. Bloomberg is spending heavily to energize Charlotte voters ahead of Super Tuesday, but it's unclear whether money can match the enthusiasm of other campaigns, like Warren's and Bernie Sanders, who have smaller but energetic ground operations in Charlotte. First, let's take a look at Bloomberg's Charlotte field office, the first one he opened nationwide. It's 17,000 square feet. It's on one of the city's most important and expensive downtown streets. It looks like a corporate headquarters. And the campaign has more than 125 paid staff in North Carolina alone, with more than two dozen in Charlotte. The campaign has hired staff to target specific groups like the LGBTQ community and veterans.
So I picked up all the talent. I got Jorge Morales. Jorge is heading up my Latino. He ran for council.
That's Charlotte City Councilmember James Mitchell, who was hired last year as Bloomberg's North Carolina field director.
I had to pick people I knew who had a relationship and great credibility.
Mitchell says he spent more than $5 million so far in the state on-the-ground campaigning, like salaries, signs, and that food truck.
It's a sprint for us. We started this in December. It was always initially taught to me, it's about Super Tuesday.
Mitchell, who is black, says he's working hard to improve Bloomberg's standing with African-American voters. He acknowledges that stop and frisk has been a hurdle, especially among younger black voters.
It's been a tough road because the African-American community for us, stop and frisk, and it's a generation thing. So you see those who 55 plus, they understand it was about policy. Those who 35 and under,
Bloomberg's campaign has received the endorsement of the city's popular African-American mayor, Vi Lyles. But progressives, including her daughter, have criticized the mayor, and Lyles has not been actively stumping for Bloomberg. Joe Biden, who was once seen as a heavy favorite in North Carolina, hasn't been as visible in Charlotte recently. His wife campaigned here Wednesday, but his campaign doesn't list a field office in the city. Longtime Charlotte political consultant Dan McCorkle says he's never seen a candidate spend as much money in the city as Bloomberg. The most effective presidential campaign he's seen was Obama in 2008, both in the primary and general election. Volunteers fueled Obama, he says.
I'd go there in the morning, they'd be sitting in the chair, and I'd come back in the afternoon, they'd be sitting in a chair.
He's not so sure if all this spending will translate into votes.
I mean, Bloomberg has money, but, you know, like I said, a well-trained, dedicated volunteers worth their weight in gold.
That's what Bernie Sanders' campaign is counting on. Its small Charlotte office, located in a classroom building that's part of a church, was home this week to a meeting of supporters preparing the canvas.
Right, we don't have billionaire donors. We don't have super PACs. It's not going to be easy. But what we can do, right, how we can do it is by talking to people, right? We have the biggest volunteer base of any campaign, right? And that's why we're going to do
it. Back at that food truck, it may not have had the draw the Bloomberg campaign was hoping for. Just an hour after opening, most of the people eating the free chicken were paid campaign workers. For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley in Columbia, South Carolina. And thanks to all of our colleagues at South Carolina Public Radio. And a special thanks to our engineer A.T. Shire and Sean Birch.
There's nothing like being out there in the country, South Carolina, Nevada, Iowa, New Hampshire.
That's right.
Super Tuesday is next. I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The new cheetah cubs at the Columbus Zoo are adorable, and they also represent a scientific breakthrough. They're the first cheetahs to be born by in vitro fertilization to a surrogate mother.
They are pretty feisty, which is great. That's what you want when you have new cheetah cubs. They're supposed to be feisty and strong.
Cheetah babies, next time on Here and Now.